The information and ideas discussed in this program are intended to be educational and to motivate listeners to take control of their own financial future. Because the subject matter is complex and situations differ widely between individuals, we strongly recommend that you consult qualified professionals before acting on the information discussed in the program.
Hello and welcome to our show today. For those of you listening to our show for the first time, I'm Jason.
I'm Peter.
And we've designed a money show for the advanced listener. If most of the coverage you hear is best described as Finance 101, this will be your graduate course in finance. On this week's show, Peter will be talking about inflation, demand pull, cost push. He'll cover the Consumer Price Index, which is an imperfect measurement of inflation, the impact of inflation on investments, and how to invest in such an environment, including coverage of Treasury inflationary protected securities, I-bonds, and commodities. And he'll discuss where inflation may be headed. The next segment will be an interview with Robert Browning. Robert's a prominent estate planning attorney, and he'll talk about a very unique and powerful method for transferring wealth to heirs. I hope you enjoy our show, and if you are new to podcasting, please make sure to visit our website at www.promoneytalk.com. On our website, we have articles that explain podcasting and how to subscribe to our show for free. You'll find that it's easy and fun, and I hope this will open you up to a whole new world of information and entertainment. Once again, our website is www.promoneytalk.com.
Today we're going to talk about inflation. We're going to talk about the causes of inflation, how it's measured, some of its shortcomings, the impact on stocks and bonds, how to invest in an inflationary environment, and finally the history of inflation and where it might be headed going forward.
Inflation is a fairly timely topic. You've probably heard people bringing it up recently, and you certainly will hear a lot more about it going forward. And we'd like to educate you on inflation and give you some tools.
So the causes of inflation, economists talk about demand pull and cost push as being a couple of the causes of inflation. Demand pull implies that so many people are competing for a given product, such as real estate or maybe a special model of a car, that the price actually gets increased because people are bidding for it fast and furious. They're willing to pay higher and higher prices for it. So that would be a demand pull example. Cost push is when inflation is driven by higher costs of the inputs for a given commodity. For instance, higher cost of steel would drive up the price of producing cars, or higher prices of cement might drive up the cost of producing buildings. So there, in that case, the cost is pushing inflation higher. Another factor that we've experienced in the last 12 months or so is a falling dollar, where a weaker dollar makes our imports more expensive, and to the extent that Americans buy imports, all things being equal, the price of the imports would be higher as well. But in the long term, the thing that really drives inflation is the money supply. If there are more dollars chasing fewer goods, then prices are going to rise in general. It was certainly the problem with Germany early in the 19th century, where they experienced hyperinflation. And even though the price of oil may rise temporarily or other factors may come into play, in the long run, it's how many dollars are printed that determines how much inflation there's going to be. In the U.S., we often talk about the Consumer Price Index as being the major measure of inflation for consumers. There are actually two consumer price indexes that are built and put together by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The one that's quoted most often is the CPI-U, which is consumer price index for all urban consumers. That covers about 87% of the total population in the country. The second index is the CPIW index for urban wage earners and clerical workers. That covers about 32% of the population. So usually you hear about the CPI-U. It actually tries to measure the changes of all goods and services purchased for consumption by urban households. Income taxes and investment items are not included in the Consumer Price Index.
What are typical investment items?
Things like stocks and bonds, the level of the stock market, for instance. So there's some 23,000 different retail and service establishments that are surveyed. The government sends workers out with clipboards and computers to try to measure what the actual prices are in stores and for consumers in a number of different urban areas, about 87 of them throughout the country. They also collect data on rents from about 50,000 landlords and tenants. So they're really trying to go out every month, continuously actually, throughout the month, and measure comparable items to get a handle on what people are paying for all goods and services.
Now, Peter, a lot of people have been talking about real estate and the increasing home prices. How is that reflected in the CPI?
The CPI doesn't look directly at home prices. It did at one time, but they felt there were some flaws in collecting data that way, that there were people investing in home prices and that they didn't want to take into account investment results. So they decided to measure what they call rental equivalence. Rental equivalence is the value to the homeowner of having a place to stay, and it's measured by comparing rents in the same areas. At this point in time, rental equivalence, I think, does a disservice to the index because rents are low and falling while house prices are actually rising. This is an example of where the CPI actually falls short in measuring what inflation actually is for consumers.
So for many consumers, the most expensive item that they may ever purchase is a home. So while rental prices may be low and the CPI shows a relatively low rate of inflation, the fact is that home prices can be rising at a faster rate and actually having a large impact on the purchasing power of Americans.
Yes, that's right. It can actually go both ways. There was a time a few years ago where rents were increasing and home prices were relatively stable. And I don't know, I'm not a mathematician or a statistician, and this is a big project to try to tackle, measuring what it costs to live in a country with hundreds of millions of people. But perhaps in the long run it all equals out, but I'd say in the short run right now that the CPI doesn't fully reflect the cost of living if you're a home buyer. Bill Gross of PIMCO, who's a famous bond manager in Southern California, estimates that the CPI actually understates inflation by about 1%. And of course, the government has an incentive to quote a relatively low inflation rate because some of the payments that they make, like for Social Security, are based on increases in the Consumer Price Index. And therefore, the higher the rate of inflation, the more they're going to have to pay out in benefits. Another area where some adjustments have been made is in product improvement. So the government says, well, yes, you have to go out and buy a new car or a new computer from time to time, but we have to take into account that the old products are no longer around, and how do we measure the new products? So they try to take into account product improvement, which means that even though the computer or the car may cost as much as last year's model, the government's going to say you're getting more for your money. So they're going to give it a lower inflation rate than would otherwise be the case. So again, the government's adjusting inflation rate downwards with an argument that sounds plausible, but I understand they include things like catalytic converters as an improvement on a car. And it may improve the environment, but it doesn't improve my life much, and yet it's not counted in the inflation rate.
So if the price of cars 5 years ago averaged $20,000 and the price today is $25,000, it's conceivable that the index value for that, instead of rising, could actually fall if they feel that the improvements are greater.
Right. In fact, I think over the last 10 years or 15 years, the actual price of cars has gone up over 6% a year in dollars, but the inflation rate that the government has used is something in the range of 2% because of the quality improvements. So the consumer price index is not a perfect indicator, and it certainly doesn't apply equally to everyone. Different people have different needs. For instance, people who are buying foreign cars at this point, eventually they're going to be paying more money as the dollar falls. If you buy a domestic car, the falling dollar is not going to have that same kind of impact. If you're buying a home at this point, it's going to be very expensive. Whereas if you already own your home, you're not experiencing that increase in inflation. So really, it's a broad number, and different parts of the country, different geographic regions will be affected differently, as will consumers with different spending needs. A really good example is seniors buying health care, where the cost is going up pretty dramatically. So that said, that's what the Consumer Price Index is, which is the measure of inflation in the United States. On the website, we have a couple of links. One is to the Consumer Price Index homepage, and we have another link to a site that leads to a lot of articles and discussion about the Consumer Price Index. That's from the University of Southern California. We also have a gasoline price history chart in dollars and inflation adjusted, and that's an interesting chart to look at. So the question for us as investors is, how do we take inflation into account in our investments, in our portfolios? All things being equal, inflation is going to hurt the value of stocks and bonds, because investors want to get a return that's going to reward them for taking risk, but also for tying up their money. They're going to be foregoing other possible investments. So when an investor puts money into a stock or a bond, they're looking at what kind of dividends or interest am I going to be paid periodically while I hold it, and what is my principal going to be worth at the end of the period. That makes a lot of sense. You know, what am I going to put out? What am I going to get back? Unfortunately, when you have inflation, it means that the value of the dollars you're going to get back in the future is going to be smaller. So the value of those investments as an investment today are going to be less, all things equal. We call it the present value of future money. We discount it back by some hurdle rate, which could be inflation, could be a risk-free interest rate.
So Peter, a lot of investors look at stocks and bonds as, again, inversely proportionate, that by diversifying between stocks and bonds, you can help protect if stocks drop. Typically, then they feel the bonds will go up and give them some protection, or vice versa. But in this case, with rising inflation, this impacts both stocks and bonds negatively.
That's right. Well, stocks and bonds do provide good diversification effects when they're put together into a portfolio. About one-third of the time, they do move differently, but two-thirds of the time, they'll move similarly. Stocks will do well in certain economic environments. Bonds will do well in other ones. But rising inflation really affects both of them and makes it difficult to find a good investment going forward. In the investment world, we talk about four main asset classes. We talk about cash, which includes CDs, money market funds, stable value accounts that pay interest. We talk about bonds, we talk about stocks, and we talk about real estate. Well, already we're ruling out two of the three main areas that people invest in, stocks and bonds, if we're talking about inflation. Cash isn't a very good alternative, because in the long run you really don't make a real return after inflation in cash investments. And real estate right now is very expensive, so it's hard to find a good inflation hedge at this point, although real estate can be a good inflation hedge in more normal times. While stocks and bonds go down with inflation, they are securities. They are promises to pay in dollars at a future time. The way to deal with inflation, one way, is to buy things. And in fact, in the early 80s, when inflation was really severe, people were loading up on all kinds of things. Survivalists were buying toilet paper and food and, you know, supplies and holding up in Montana, and there was a lot of fear about the future price of things. So buying now was the way to go.
I remember also things like vintage cars. The prices increased quite a bit. Collectibles increased quite a bit.
And that would make sense, because it took more and more dollars to buy the same things. So you didn't want to own dollars or things denominated in dollars. You wanted to own things where the value would increase in terms of dollars. So the things, you know, it doesn't give us a lot of options in the investment world, but we do have access to things like commodities, which are different kinds of stuff. There's energy commodities, there's food commodities, there's industrial materials, and we can access those through financial instruments like mutual funds and futures.
Let me take a step back, Peter, and maybe explain to people what commodities are. Commodities are the actual building blocks. So, for instance, Alcoa is primarily known for aluminum. Alcoa, as a company, is a stock. Aluminum itself is the commodity.
All right. So, again, we're talking about stuff. When you buy a commodity, in essence, you're buying the raw materials. You are temporarily the owner and controller of that. In the old days, when we bought commodities, if we didn't sell the contract, we would take delivery on the actual commodity. And so there were a lot of jokes about taking delivery of pig bellies and plywood and wheat, you know, on your front lawn, boxcars worth, if you didn't get out of your contract before it expired. These days, we can do it through mutual funds. We can do it without additional leverage, which means less volatility. We can own a variety of different kinds of things without placing all of our bets in one single narrow area, and we can take advantage of inflation as investors that way. Let me back up for a second because I mentioned financial leverage, and some people may not be familiar with that term. Financial leverage is buying something by putting a down payment on it and borrowing the rest of the money. And what that creates is an exaggerated effect of profit and loss to the investor. And we deal with this in our homes all the time. We'll put 20% down on a home, and we don't realize what we've done there is to exaggerate the effect of the returns to us, because all of the returns go to the investor or to the buyer, none to the bank. So I put 20% down on a home. If it goes up 10% in value, I've made 50%. If you put 100% down on a home and it goes up 10% in value, you're only making 10%. So if you buy other investments that don't always go up, and homes don't either, when you use leverage, you borrow part of the money to buy something, you're increasing your risk, both on the upside and the downside. We used to buy commodities with about 2% down. So if the price moved 2%, you would be either wiped out or you'd double your money. But we can buy commodities now without that kind of leverage and without that kind of risk. So one of the things we can do to fight inflation as investors is to buy things, and not necessarily to take delivery, but to hold them in our portfolio. Another thing we can do is to buy stocks and bonds in other currencies. So we can invest overseas in bonds issued by foreign governments, in stocks issued by foreign corporations. And when the dollar sinks, the value of those investments goes up for the American investor, because we still spend dollars here at home, but we're holding some German Deutschmarks or French francs, whatever, that may be going up in value. So we can spread our risk by holding not only different kinds of investments, but different kinds of currencies around the world.
In other words, inflation very well could be a domestic issue and not an issue in other countries.
That's correct. Of course, there is the risk that inflation could become a global phenomenon. The European Central Bank has been fighting harder against inflation than we have. So even if all countries have some degree of inflation, if it's a little bit out of sync with each other, or if it's a little bit less dramatic, you've still got some diversification benefit from that. So it doesn't have to be perfect. We're just looking to reduce risk any way we can. And we do have some concerns that inflation in the future could be higher than it has been in recent years.
Let me ask you about another investment that a lot of people may know of and that I think will become increasingly popular as inflation becomes a more talked about issue, and that is securities that have an inflation protection built in.
The U.S. government a few years ago came out with a bond called the Treasury Inflation Protected Security, and these bonds not only pay some interest rate depending on the environment when they're issued, they're sold at auction like other kinds of treasuries, so the initial interest rate is set through the auction process, but in addition to the interest that the bond pays, they also pay an adjustment every year based on the consumer price index. So if the bond has a 1.5% yield and inflation is 3%, the bond will pay a total of 4.5% in that year. So the nice thing about those bonds is you're always going to at least do as well as inflation and have some extra interest. The bonds do fluctuate in value just like other bonds do while they're in existence. But if you hold them till maturity, again, you have the certainty of the income payments and inflation adjustment. They're not going to make anybody rich because they're so safe. You're not taking a lot of risk, but they do have that low risk gives them good return to risk ratio. So they can be a valuable tool. And actually in all types, all sectors of investment, bonds, in stocks, and in real estate, there are certain types that might provide better inflation protection and less risk than other types. So we do try to find less vulnerable investments in each of those broad areas.
So there are, in bonds, there are treasury inflationary protected securities, which we call TIPS. You'll also hear people say I-bonds.
That's right. I-bonds are the savings bond equivalent of the treasury inflation protected securities. I-bonds are issued directly to consumers through the Federal Reserve and through banks. There is a maximum that an investor can buy every year. I believe it's
$30,000.
And they're issued at, I don't know if they're issued at half that value, putative. Usually they have a maturity at one price and an issue at the beginning price. So $30,000 a year per household.
That's right.
And they guarantee, again, to pay the inflation rate plus an interest rate. Those bonds do not fluctuate while you own them. And they don't have a secondary market. You would redeem them directly with the Federal Reserve. And if you trade them in or sell them back to the government within 5 years, you do have some penalty, just as you would with Series EE savings bonds. So those are the direct with the government savings plan.
And I think both I-bonds and TIPS, as I said, are going to become, people are going to become more aware of them, especially retirees who are some of the most vulnerable people in periods of inflation.
Well, they certainly play a key role for protecting the value of the fixed income portion of the portfolio. Looking back historically, going back to 1940, there have been a couple of periods of high inflation. In the late 40s, after World War II, of course, we'd been spending a lot of money on the war effort, and inflation hit a high of just over 14% in 1947. It had been fluctuating between about 4 and 10% throughout most of the 40s. We had low inflation during the 50s and relatively low inflation in the 60s. By the mid-70s, though, the Vietnam War was beginning to create some deficit problems, and inflation started to pick up with not only that, but the oil embargo. So in 74, we had inflation over 10%, and by 1980, we were over 10% 3 years in a row, which means that consumers and investors would have lost one-third of their value of their money in 3 years, which is pretty severe. Chairman Volcker of the Federal Reserve stepped in 1980 or 81, I forget which exact year it was, and broke the back of inflation by beginning to control the money supply instead of trying to set interest rates. And when he did, he allowed interest rates to go as high as the market would carry them without worrying about the effect on the economy. And that very quickly brought inflation back down. All of the talk about whip inflation now, Jerry Ford's motto, where consumers and labor and businesses were supposed to voluntarily control wages and prices, really didn't work. People just can't do it out of the sheer goodness of their hearts and manage to make a concerted effort that has any impact. But higher inflation rates definitely did it. So we've had low inflation since the early 80s. Beginning to perk up a little bit now. I haven't looked at the last 12-month number, but it's in the range of 3%, which is somewhat probably tolerable. Although it still eats away at the value of investments and means that people have to be careful when they retire to have enough money to last because the cost of living is going to be inexorably going up. I'm a little concerned going forward because there's a lot of debt that the government is carrying and consumers are carrying, and it seems to me that there will be more political pressure on the powers that be in the country to allow some inflation, because as inflation comes back and workers earn more money as a result, because wages rise with it, it makes it easier to pay back debts, especially debts that are at fixed rates. So the overhang of the amount of debt that we have in the consumer and public sectors in this country, we simply can't afford to have much inflation, higher interest rates, and have to pay it back. The payments have been low because we have low interest rates. But if interest rates start to rise, it's going to become very, very difficult for debtors to be paying back debt, and it could become a real problem. I don't know how far our country can go in allowing inflation to come back, because we'll pay another price if we do. And that price is that foreign investors will lose confidence in our currency, and investment capital will go to other places rather than to the U.S. All countries are in competition to win investment dollars. And if we lose that confidence, we'll be paying a much higher price and not getting the capital that we need. So we need to have some discipline. I'm not sure how it's all going to play out, but we're keeping an eye on it. And we're trying to pick investments that will protect our investors from the serious damage that inflation can do to portfolios.
And I might add to the damage that perceived inflation can do. In other words, there's always a story in the media, and if inflation starts to rise even at a moderate level, you can expect that that story will gain prominence. And even if a moderate inflation is good, as you suggest, for the government to reduce its debt, and if they are able to keep inflation moderate, there's still some concern that markets may still react disfavorably, anticipating larger inflation rates than actually occur.
There's often a disconnect between perception and reality. I was reading today that one of the Federal Reserve representatives hears a lot from consumers that inflation isn't as low as they say it is. So perception and reality can diverge, and it can create political pressures for sure. Even though gasoline is at a high cost right now per dollar or per gallon, historically, inflation adjusted, it's not as high as it was in the early 80s. So the political pressures come from people's perceptions, not necessarily reality. So we need to keep that in mind too.
Today we're talking to Robert Browning from WealthPlan. We're going to be talking to Robert about intentionally defective irrevocable trusts, what we call defective trusts, and in the estate planning world they call IDITs. As I said, Robert's an attorney with WealthPlan. WealthPlan's in San Jose, California. WealthPlan's a law practice that's dedicated to the preservation of family wealth. It was founded to provide services for clients of substantial means seeking a multifaceted approach to their estate planning. So Robert, first let me ask you, what's a defective trust, and what's the goal of setting up a defective trust?
Under the tax code, there are differences between the income tax law and the estate and gift tax law. And by defective, it means that the trust under the income tax code is not treated as coming into existence. Thereby, it was defective. For income tax purposes, it's not a real trust. But, like I said, because of the differences in the code sections, under estate and gift tax rules, it is treated as being a valid trust.
So, under estate planning law, it's a valid trust, but under tax code, it's not valid.
Correct, right. Okay. And that's where the defect comes in under income tax. Under estate tax, it's just a regular irrevocable trust.
Okay. We'll talk about the benefits of that structure later. But first, let's talk about what type of client would benefit from a defective trust.
The typical client we like to recommend these for are, first, someone who has already given away a lot of assets, so they've used up the majority of their unified credit.
Okay, and how much is the unified credit?
For lifetime giving, it's $1 million.
Okay.
So one, if they've used up unified credit, this is a good tool.
Okay.
Two, they have a asset that's low in value but has a chance for substantial appreciation in the near future.
Such as
closely held stock in companies that are planning on IPOs or being purchased, being bought at some point soon. Venture funds where the potential profit is unknown at that time. Real estate is a good one. Real estate's a very good one because it throws off cash typically. And two, they have a lot of cash available for part of the transaction. There's going to be sales involved. It's good to have either an asset that throws off a lot of cash or cash reserves that you can use within the structure of the transaction.
First thing was that they've used up their uniform credit. And for a couple, the uniform credit is $2 million. For a married couple, it'd be $2 million.
Correct.
They have assets that are highly appreciable assets. And the third would be that they have a fair amount of cash or an asset that throws off a lot of cash.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So can you tell me a little bit about how a defective trust is structured?
In most ways, other than the one defect, it's set up much like any other trust. You need a grantor or a trustor, someone who's going to set it up. In this case, this is the person who's going to own this asset and want to transfer it downstream to kids or grandkids. You have beneficiaries who are typically the children, and a lot of times these work well, including grandchildren. So you have dynastic capabilities within an IDIT. You have a trustee. One of the things, because it is an irrevocable trust, the grantor cannot be the trustee of this trust. So a beneficiary could. So if you have a child that is old enough or trusted enough, they could be the trustee. A lot of times, like a financial advisor or a trust company are good ideas to put in place there, simply because you're going to be transferring like a potentially highly appreciating asset that you're going to need to diversify at some point. So it's a lot of times better to have a professional in as the trustee. And then it's funded much like any other trust. Assets are transferred in. The thing effectively is the grantor, trustor transfers an asset to the trust. The person who set up the trust is given a power, and usually the trustor retains the ability to substitute assets into the trust.
So we've covered the goal of setting up a defective trust, what type of client would benefit from the defective trust, how it's structured. Let's talk then about the defective trust. Let's kind of walk through the process. What would you do for a client? And give us the reasons why.
Okay, so we have a client who doesn't have unified credit, or not much, so they don't want to make any sort of gift. We would set up the grantor, the person who owns the property, would set up this trust.
All right.
Now we've made it defective. They have retained the power to substitute assets. They next, instead of making a gift, which it would be for the gift tax rules, because this trust is a separate entity, you sale the assets to the trust.
Okay.
Since the trust doesn't exist for income tax purposes, it's not a sale. You can't sell things to yourself. And so you sell the asset to this trust in exchange for a promissory note. And the note is for the fair market value of the asset you're transferring in at the time. And depending on what type of asset, it's usually probably a discounted fair market value. So you're getting less than what fair market value says for various reasons. And then the note is typically set up to be interest only. So the transfer is complete as a sale for gift and estate tax purposes. So this asset is now outside of the estate of the person who owns it and is owned by this trust with their children and grandchildren as beneficiaries. Now there's no gift tax, there's no generation skipping tax, or there won't be any estate taxes at a later time because they have been purchased for full and adequate consideration, which is represented by the note. And now the person who transferred the asset has in their estate a note which has frozen the value of these assets at their current fair market value, which is going to be much lower, hopefully, than what it'll be 5-10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And then the trust does have an obligation to make interest payments, and that's where the income comes in, where the cash comes in. If the asset is throwing off enough cash to pay the interest for a year, simply it pays it to the grantor. The grantor is going to be taxed on that cash anyway because it's treated as the owner of these assets still for income tax purposes. So nothing really is changing income-wise. So this person is retaining the income they already would have had, so they're not put in a precarious income situation, but they are getting an asset that is due to appreciate substantially out of their estate.
Can you ever gift or sell your note?
The note is transferable. There is no requirement that it has to be fixed. It is freely transferable and sold out of the estate. There are always those possibilities to help move the asset completely out of the person's estate, so you could gift it down to someone. But then you've gotten highly appreciating asset out of your estate, and then you've also gotten the note without having to pay any premiums to have it canceled. You've gifted that out of your estate for the cost of your unified credit. And also notes, promissory notes, are discountable because depending on the length of the term, if they're secured, unsecured. So there are some things you can do with the notes.
Like you said before, there's a lot of flexibility.
Oh, yeah, that is the thing. We do a lot of these in our practice, and there's probably not any two that have been the same. There's always some variance or a lot of different things you can do within this basic structure.
A common theme of our show is that you really need to go to a professional for specific advice. So if someone's looking at a trust like this, you would want to go to someone who has a lot of experience in these particular types of trusts, not just any estate planning. Because it is fairly complex and because there is so much flexibility, you want something that's tailored. Robert, I'd like to show the listeners what someone actually might save. Let's run through a typical example. I have a client who has an asset worth $10 million. The client is, well, let's say it's a couple and they're both 65, and I bring them to you in an effort to transfer that asset or transfer that wealth to their children and grandchildren. Run us through this scenario and show us how much that client would save.
Okay. We would set up an IDID. That would be the first step. They would then take this asset worth $10 million and sell it to the trust in return for a self-canceling installment note. And during the transfer, these assets, whatever they are, most things are restricted in some way. They're closely held. They're not marketable. There's usually some restriction on them. So the average restriction across the board for various types of assets, you usually get about 30% discount on the asset. So the terms of the sale would, instead of being for $10 million, you would be selling $10 million worth of assets for $7 million. So they're sold to the trust for $7 million. The trust gives a note back to our couple, who are 65. Since we want the note to cancel, we also have to include a premium. So the value of the assets discounted is $7 million. Given their ages and that they're both a couple, your lifespan's a little bit longer, you'd need about $1 million premium added into the note. So you add that to the principal. You can add up the principal or interest, but with low interest rates, you want to keep them low, so you're better off adding it to principal. So we add it to principal, a note comes back to the couple for $8 million, let's say at a 5% interest rate.
Okay.
So now we have the trust set up. We've got kids, grandkids as the beneficiary. We've not incurred any gift, estate tax, or any income tax setting this whole thing up. And once they're in the trust's hands, essentially restrictions can be removed, things can be done to these assets. So right off the bat, I would say we've already transferred $10 million worth of assets for an $8 million note. So we've already gotten rid of essentially $2 million out of this couple's estate. Theoretically, let's say they live for 20 years, okay, to the age of 85. And let's say just the asset's going to appreciate at 7% a year, which, okay, is a fairly conservative appreciation for most assets.
Right.
So over 7% over 20 years, every 10 years the value is going to double, essentially. So at the end of 20 years, over here on the trust side, we have an asset that is worth $40 million. And now here at the couple side, we're going to also assume that between annual exclusion, because we have quite a few beneficiaries over here, and with the income that's thrown off by the asset, we're able to satisfy the $400,000 in interest payments a year. So the couple was able to maintain a steady income flow for their lifetime. So essentially, the note has not appreciated any. It's still worth $8 million. But however, since when we set this up, we included the $1 million premium to make it a self-canceling note, the note at their death immediately cancels, and there is no longer an obligation in their estate. This couple has transferred an asset that is now worth $40 million, and what is left in their estate is absolutely nothing attached to this asset. And at today's rates, without taking into account credits or anything like that, that's about a $16 million tax bill.
So by planning ahead, we're able to save in taxes, we're able to save $16 million in this scenario. In our conversations before, we're talking about highly appreciable assets, or we're talking about stocks or companies. So it's very likely that this could be actually a lot larger. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. Thank you to Robert for being our guest. Next week, we've got another great show for you. Continuing on the wealth transfer theme, Peter will be talking about proper communication with family and attorneys, including his own family's story, which will serve as an example of how improper communication can have a disastrous effect on an estate plan. Once again, our website is www.promoneytalk.com. If you have any comments or questions, you can find our email addresses there. Until next week, for Peter, I'm Jason, and have a great week.